While working at Control Data Corporation, computer designer Seymour Cray was once asked his 5 and 1 year goals. He said, 5 year goal, build the biggest computer in the world. 1 year goal, 1/5 of the above. Seymour Cray literally only wanted one thing, and that was to take it to the limit. In today's video, we look back at a genius's lifelong quest to make the biggest supercomputers. But first, this video is brought to you by the Asianometry Patreon. Early access members get to see new videos first and selected references for those videos. Early access really helps a lot, and I appreciate every pledge. Thank you, and on with the show. Seymour Cray Jr. was born in the small town of Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin in 1925, the son of a civil engineer at the local power utility. The elder Cray fostered in his son a love for science and engineering. The son adored chemistry, did electrician work for his junior prom, and showed a talent for radio. After serving in the Army as an electrician, Cray went to university on the GI Bill and graduated from the University of Minnesota with a bachelor's in electrical engineering and a master's in applied math. Then in 1950, he joined a small company called Engineering Research Associates, or ERA, in St. Paul, Minnesota. During World War II, the U.S. Navy employed a team of elite codebreakers. This division was known as the Communications Supplementary Activity Washington, or SESAW, and in secret, they designed and built powerful machines to break access naval codes, mostly to find German submarines. At the war's end, people realized that the U.S. government still needed to break codes, Soviet codes this time, but with budget cuts, they cannot afford to keep their employees. So the Navy worked with an investment banker named John Parker to set up a for-profit company that would hire and employ the old team at higher salaries. This was ERA. ERA's people worked largely in secret out of an old glider factory. Their first products were code-breaking machines, like before. But the team quickly began moving towards useful general-purpose computers, leveraging emerging technologies like magnetic drum memory. One of the first such products was the ERA 1101. The computer was a commercialized version of a device sold to one of the precursors of the NSA. You can say that Minnesota in the 1950s was Silicon Valley before Silicon Valley existed. Thanks to the strong military presence, it was America's premier computing center. Despite being just 25 years old, Cray showed himself to be a talented worker. Cray was quiet, but had the unshakable confidence to speak up when something was wrong. He had incredible focus and rigid discipline, and of course, he was brilliant, with a gift for understanding the world of binary numbers. Thus, Cray was challenged to produce the control system for ERA's next computer, the ERA 1103. The control system breaks down the software's instructions into execution steps. Control system design required front-to-back knowledge of the computer's guts, because it had to coordinate all those resources to efficiently execute the program. Cray did the work and quickly rose up the ranks to supervise the team. Like another legend of the times, An Wang of Wang Labs, Seymour Cray's genius can make him sometimes difficult to work for. Cray preferred to work alone, spending late nights in the workshop. If someone wasn't doing it right or was taking too long, he reassigned them and did it himself. They called it being scrayed. But despite being very quiet, Seymour treated his colleagues well and was generally liked and respected. Just a bit eccentric and enigmatic, exactly as a genius computer designer should be. In December 1951, President and original investor John Parker sold ERA to the computer company, Remington Rand. Parker didn't tell the employees at ERA about this, which in bird culture is considered a dick move. And it angered key workers like William Norris, who joined early and rose to become VP of operations. Remington Rand was a typewriter and shaver company. Why computers? Even more strangely, Rand had already bought a computer company earlier, the Eckert-Mockley Computer Corporation. J. Presper Eckert and John Mockley will forever be known for making ENIAC, the first programmable digital computer, and then EDVAC, pioneering the stored program computer design that today underpins the von Neumann architecture. Along the way, Eckert also created the first course on electronic digital computers, the Moore School Lectures, which helped popularize the von Neumann architecture, no relation to Moore's Law. And then UNIVAC 1, a computer that garnered renown for predicting that some dude named Dwight Eisenhower would win the 1952 U.S. presidential election. The world-famous Eckert and Mauchly had serious computer credentials, so the guys at ERA accepted the arrangement. Eckert Mauchly would focus on the business computer marketplace, while ERA focused on scientific computing. But tensions remained. Today, the computing needs of both business and science can be handled by a general-purpose computer, but in those days, the computers had to be more specific. Computers for business did simple operations, adding, subtracting, and multiplying, and with only 2 decimal points of accuracy. However, this had to be done at large scale, thousands of rows going in and out of the computer. Scientific computing was different in that it required complex calculations with up to 20 to 30 decimal points of accuracy. Such a computer might munch on a problem for hours just to produce a single line of output. The guys at Eckert Mauchly in Philadelphia looked down on the Minnesota guys as mere quote-unquote farmers who did not work on the state of the art, and the Minnesota guys saw the Philadelphians as theoreticians who only cared about making computers faster, even if it meant them breaking down a lot. Things got worse in 1955 when RAND merged with the Sperry Corporation to become Sperry RAND. The merger forced together the 2 formerly independent units into 1 UNIFAC division. The tensions really flared between ERA, Eckert, and their new corporate overlords. The aforementioned William Norris, the division's new general manager, said to the Philadelphia guys, "You people run a laboratory, and ERA runs a business." When Sperry took over, its top management, including President Harry Vickers, thought that they were buying a market leader. That was not the case. UNIVAC had the potential to be what IBM eventually became, but it needed the capital to get there. Not only in R&D to build the machines, but also because computers were an equipment leasing business back then. It was very capital intensive. In 1957, enough was enough. Norris left Sperry RAND to found a new company, Control Data Corporation, or CDC. A new company was a huge risk, but Norris figured that if it did not work, then he and his family could go back to their farm in Nebraska. Norris invited a few of his ERA co-workers to come with him. Cray was one of those who accepted, having seen the writing on the wall when he noticed an accounting system categorize his project as 999, miscellaneous, and other. CDC started in July 1957 with its employees, a vague idea to make computers, and some money from friends. No plant, no product, and little money. To get the company off the ground, CDC IPO'd. Like literally, they stood on the street and sold shares to ordinary members of the public for $1 each. This is probably not possible today. The company got its first splash of publicity from an unexpected spot. Sid Hartman, a sports columnist at the Minneapolis Tribune and former part-time general manager of the Minneapolis Lakers, mentioned the move at the end of one of his sports column. Many prominent local investors declined an investment in CDC, one saying that they, quote, didn't have a ghost of a chance, end quote, against IBM. Decliners included a guy named Warren Buffett. Despite being William Norris's nephew by marriage, he declined due to a lack of understanding. Bet he's poor now and deeply regrets that. Years later, the $1 shares would be worth about many times that. The early CDC IPO enriched the company's 300 initial investors and created a generation of new wealth in the Minnesota area. Cray was the most technical person at the new company and persuaded his co-founders to build scientific computers rather than going to the commercial market. His reasoning was that their clientele, universities and nuclear weapons research labs, cared less about marketing and client service, and they programmed their own software. What they wanted was compute, serious compute. Due to treaty obligations, you can't just test fire a nuclear weapon, and even discounting the environmental issues cannot easily measure its workings. So, to study a detonation, we needed computers to simulate the bomb's chain reactions, stepping through all the equations every microsecond after detonation. That means the biggest and fastest computers on the market. Cray was convinced that he could build such a computer at a relatively bearable cost using transistors. He went down to the local electronics shop and found that they were selling reject bipolar transistors for radios for cheaper than what you can get from the factory. These reject transistors suck, outputting a weak signal. So, Cray paired them up in what is called a Darlington pair, with the second transistor amplifying the output of the first. The experience taught him that, with the right design, you can use substandard components and still achieve the goal. Over a year into the venture, with money running low, Bill Norris strikes a deal with the US Navy for what would be called the CDC-1604 computer in 1958. But now they have to build it at scale, buying a factory and hiring more engineers. Norris and other managers cut their salaries in half to save money. Engineers resorted to swiping transistor companies as free sales samples for their computer. The CDC-1604 first hit the market in 1960, carrying a price tag of $990,000, or about $10.4 million today. At 0.2 MHz, it was the most powerful commercially available computer of the time, a supercomputer. A supercomputer is a bit of a squishy term. It's about pushing the envelope in computing, bringing out a computer that leads all others in its field. Control Data was not alone in the market of producing superfast computers for niche customers. UNIVAC released the Livermore Automatic Reaction Calculator, LARC, in 1960, the same year as the 1604's release. It helped Edward Teller do simulations for the hydrogen bomb and was the most powerful computer in the world from 1960 to 1961. The LARC scared IBM so much that they built the IBM 7030 stretch supercomputer, designed by the legendary Gene Amdahl. The 7030 took back the crown of the world's most powerful supercomputer and retained it until 1964. But the LARC and Stretch were basically made-to-order products. UNIVAC only made two LARC units. Control Data turned the supercomputer into a category, a commercially successful one at that. The 1604 sold to the University of Illinois, Lockheed, the State of Israel, and more. The company began to turn a profit, challenging the old computer giants like Rand and IBM. CDC stock went from $1 to $9, and now Norris had to keep the engineers from selling their stock too early. After the 1604, Cray and CDC debated about how to proceed, follow up on the 1604, and finally attack the lucrative business data processing market. This would mean iterating on the 1604 architecture, making smaller computers like the CDC-160A a very good and successful control applications computer. But Cray only wanted to build the fastest possible machine. The scientific community had only started to realize a new form of computational modeling, finite element analysis, which I mentioned in a prior video. Finite element analysis involves splitting something down into millions of simpler elements and running simulations based on how those elements might act. For instance, breaking a car down into tiny shapes and using that to predict how it might survive a car crash. With finite element analysis, the more steps you can break something down into, the better you can model and predict complex systems like the weather or nuclear explosions. This basically implied an infinite need for compute. Cray wanted to be the guy to feed that need for speed. He threatened to leave the company over this issue, which caused Norris to eventually agree on splitting the two teams. One CDC team would work on a 1604 follow-up. Meanwhile, the 35-year-old Cray and his team were allowed to open their own lab in Cray's hometown of Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. This new lab was just a brief stroll from his house. There, Cray and his team worked on a machine some 15 times faster than the 1604, named the 6600. When Cray and his team sat down to make the CDC-6600, they started off with something like the 1604. The 1604 was built with ferrite magnetic cores for main memory and magnetic tape for secondary storage. For compute, it had germanium transistors. Everything was built inside air-cooled, pluggable building blocks. But as they worked on the 6600, Cray changed many things. Critically, he sourced silicon planar transistors from Fairchild. They switched far faster than germanium transistors, automatically granting a 5x speed boost. The rest of the 10 to 15x speedup goal, though, had to come from somewhere else. Cray soon soured on the building block approach. Each block had extensive back panel wiring, which not only caused noise issues but also limited input-output and increased how long it took to transmit data. So Cray threw it all out and switched to using denser, more complex custom modules called cordwood modules. The shorter wires improved speed, but also made it difficult to repair and necessitated the replacement of air cooling with freon gas cooling. Another concept they implemented was parallelism. Every system has to do housekeeping functions or the such in addition to the main compute task. Why should the main processor have to do that? Offload it to something else. The 6600 contained 11 individual computers that can execute programs separately from each other. They only shared a central memory. 10 of the computers handled secondary work like peripherals, leaving the 11th computer free to do nothing but high-speed math. Additionally, the 6600 lived and breathed simplicity. A computer CPU uses something called an instruction set architecture, or ISA, to define its basic operations, thus also defining how software can control it. The 6600 simplified its ISA, ditching everything unrelated to scientific computing, like for instance instructions for handling large amounts of data, something more geared for commercial users. This simplified instruction set allowed the computer to quote-unquote pipeline tasks, breaking down a bigger job to smaller ones that can be assigned to peripheral computers to work on simultaneously. CDC delivered its first 6600 to Lawrence Livermore in 1964. The machine's incredible speed, three times faster than the 7030, shocked IBM. Chairman Thomas J. Watson Jr. wrote a scathing memo asking how, quote, 34 people, including the janitor, end quote, beat the biggest technology company in the world. The answer, of course, was that IBM's architects could not bear to sacrifice compatibility for speed. The splitting of the teams within Control Data prevented a blow-up, but discontent continued to fester. Norris and other managers continued to build up the business. CDC began making its own peripherals and software to accompany the main computer, building a services business. Control Data also purchased a consumer finance company, Commercial Credit, intending to use their $3.4 billion of working capital to fund its computer leasing strategy. This strategy, which seemed smart at the time, eventually backfired when Commercial Credit ran into difficulties. Over 100 CDC 6600s were sold to big customers like the Atomic Energy Commission, but each cost $8 million, or about $23 million today. As you might think, it limited the market to about 50 total customers in the world. But Seymour Cray felt this was a feature, not a bug. He loved knowing the first names of each of his customers. Yet Control Data's management was increasingly coming to the belief that peripherals and services, not hardware, were the company's future. Control Data followed up the CDC 6600 with the 7600, and it was hailed as the world's fastest computer, five times faster than the 6600. But despite costing only twice as much of its predecessor, it sold poorly, in part due to frequent breakdowns and a weak economy. Then after that, we had the 8600. This supercomputer was made with regular discrete transistors, but Cray wanted a clock cycle time of 8 nanoseconds, which meant every wire had to be shorter than 2.5 meters, squeezing those parts very close together. Things got so dense that Cray couldn't figure out how to sufficiently cool them. After many months, he decided to throw everything out and start again from scratch. It was his style, the Cray way. But this was 1971, and Control Data was in the midst of an expensive antitrust lawsuit against IBM. Cash flow was running low. Cray was asked to cut expenses by 10%. Unwilling to do that, he cut his own salary to minimum wage, or $1.25 an hour. This did not solve the issue, and in the end, Norris told Cray that a redo like before could not be done. They already pre-sold two 8600 systems. And in 1972, Cray decided to leave and start his own shop, Cray Research. Seymour Cray founded Cray Research with $2.5 million, 20% of which was his own money, and a bunch of bank loans. The company's goal was to build the biggest computer, one at a time, like a master artisan. It did not care for big revenues, nor did it expect them. The focus was on research rather than manufacture, like Star Trek, plumbing the outer limits of possibility. In a show of goodwill, Norris and Control Data arranged a luncheon to say goodbye and invested $250,000 in the new company. Norris called it heart money. For his first computer, the Cray 1, Seymour Cray wanted revolutionary performance. To get it, he decided to turn to a new concept, vector processing. Most CPUs of the time used scalar processing, meaning they processed single data items, like integers or floating point numbers, one at a time. So imagine the job of adding one and one. A scalar CPU would load the first one into its register from memory, load the second one, add them, and then store the result into memory. Counted up, this job used 4 instructions. So if we are summing up 2 sets of 20 numbers, that is 80 instructions that a scalar CPU has to handle. A vector processing machine shortcuts that by processing single-dimension arrays of data, vectors. So if we have those 2 vectors containing 20 numbers each, loading the 2 vectors into the register, adding them, and storing the result vector into memory, that only uses 4 instructions rather than 80. Control Data knew about vector processing too. They had a small team working on a vector computer called the Star 100, but the Star was tremendously complicated and failed to live up to its promises. Control Data shipped it 4 years late and sold only 3 of them. Cray studied the Star 100 and realized its flaws. First, its scalar processing was slow, bottlenecking the overall system performance. And second, the computer's vector processing implementation had a hitch. Recall my example from before. Before you can run the addition operation on the 2 vectors, you first have to load them both into the register. Same with sending the results back to memory. The problem was that this was taking too long. Doesn't matter how much faster vector processing is compared to scalar processing if handling the vectors took forever. So Cray introduced vector registers, very fast intermediate memory systems that worked like cache memory to improve speed. Seymour also decided to adopt integrated circuits for the first time. This allowed for more density and cut down on wiring, allowing the Cray 1 to be far smaller than its predecessors. By then, ICs were roughly about 14 years old, and quite mature, but reflects Cray's approach of choosing older technologies, quote, a decade behind, end quote, as he liked to say, so that they are more reliable. But when it came to memory, Cray could not compromise. He broke his principle and bought bipolar semiconductor memory chips to replace the old core memories. It cost less, had more density, and ate less power. The computer's clock cycle of 12.5 nanoseconds made it 5 times faster than the CDC 7600, so every wire in the machine had to be less than 4 feet long. And of course, you can't forget its iconic look. A circular shape to accommodate the new cooling scheme, but with an added bit of flair to differentiate from the boring gray boxes of the era. And it had cushions too. The Cray 1 made a huge stir upon its release in 1976 with its flashy look and world-beating speed. 100 Cray 1s were sold to various government and university lab customers like the National Center for Atmospheric Research and the Department of Defense. It generated 150% revenue growth for Cray Research from 1978 to 1979, with another 50% growth a year after that. The orders came in so fast, one a month, which is a lot for an $8 million product, that a big backlog developed. IBM did not even try to compete. Cray's former employer, Control Data, found itself thrown off its feet. They tried producing vector computers like the Cyber 205, but they had gotten bloated and complicated, unable to keep up. The company suffered large financial losses and eventually sold itself off in pieces. By the mid-1980s, CDC's most profitable business was Ticketron, a rival to the widely despised Ticketmaster. As I said, Seymour Cray wanted to build the fastest computer, and to build it from a clean piece of paper. Even as the Cray 1 was in the late stages of development, Seymour started to shift his gaze towards a machine even more ambitious, the Cray 2, with a clock speed some 3 to 6 times faster than its predecessor. Such a machine had obstacles. With that clock speed, no wire can be longer than 40 centimeters, again bringing back the same heating challenges Cray faced with the 8600. And to his dismay, Seymour could not focus on solving these problems because his business needed him. To fund early development, Cray Research IPO'd its stock, which brought on a whole load of new responsibilities. And a bit poetically, the company's success caused new headaches. Since each Cray One was hand-wired and custom-made like some limited-edition supercar, a process that took a year, the company had no choice but to staff up to deliver on its big backlog. From 1978 to 1980, the company grew from 300 to 500 people, rapid growth. And at its peak, Cray Research employed over 5,000 people in the tiny town of Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. Seymour originally pursued scientific computing because users wrote their own hardware. It let him just focus on hardware. But times had changed. Customers no longer had the budget to rewrite their software every time. They wanted portability. It is why the Unix operating system got to be so popular. So Cray's customers were increasingly interested in getting a better Cray 1 than a radically different Cray 2, which would require them to redo all their software. It was the story of control data and the 1604 all over again. Eventually, Cray Research's management, including CEO John Rollwagon, did the dual approach once more. On one side, they extended the Cray 1 line with the 1S, still a powerful computer but not radically different like a Cray 2 might be. Meanwhile, Seymour Cray stepped down as chairman in 1981, handing that job over to the CEO Rollwagon, and became an independent contractor so that he could work on the Cray 2. He moved to Boulder, Colorado to work in peace once more. The Cray 2 eventually did come out in 1985, after three false starts on the cooling system. Famously, it had this massive liquid immersion cooling system that caused the machine to resemble an aquarium. Even so, memory latency caused the system to underperform its full potential. Then, to the surprise of many, Seymour's Cray 2 found itself upstaged by another computer produced by a separate team, the Cray XMP supercomputer. The XMP team was led by a longtime Cray collaborator named Les Davis, as well as a talented young Taiwanese-American designer named Steve Chen. Where the Cray 1 had a single CPU, the XMP introduced parallel processing with four CPUs along with new solid-state storage semiconductors. Released in 1983, the XMP was the world's fastest supercomputer, 2 to 5 times faster than the 1S, without the radical design changes of the Cray 2. People were stunned. It sold very well compared to the Cray 2. By 1989, there were only 24 units of the Cray 2 sold, as compared to the almost 200 units sold of the XMP and its immediate successor, the YMP. There were other changes. In the 1970s, Cray had no competitors for its unique part of the market. But throughout the 1980s, new supercomputer competitors started to emerge out of the woodwork. First, over in Japan, where Fujitsu, Hitachi, and NEC leveraged Japan's growing advantages in VLSI semiconductor production to make compelling supercomputers. Cray still dominated the market. In 1988, they had 56% market share of traditional supercomputers, but the Japanese altogether had 37% and were making ground. In a similar vein, supercomputer startups like Thinking Machines and N-Cube began exploring new approaches of supercomputing beyond just vector computing, the most prominent of which are massively parallel systems, or MPPs. These systems coordinate many commercial microprocessors to do millions or even billions of floating point operations each second. These microprocessors being bought off the shelf meant far better price for performance. This combined competition from the startups, the Japanese, and even old friends like Control Data supercomputer spin-off ETA Systems put a lot of pressure on Cray to focus this approach and its product lineup. Cray Research's unexpected success with the XMP would come back to haunt it. Designer Steve Chen was featured as one of the company's young, exciting, rising talents, the next Seymour Cray even. But unfortunately, the aggressive vision that Chen and his team had for the MP line after the YMP spiraled beyond what the company can financially support. 64 processors, custom integrated circuits, and maybe even optical interconnects. In 1987, the company was already invested in developing Seymour Cray's next machine, the Cray 3, and the YMP, in addition to three existing products that needed money too. They had no money for Chen's science fiction dream. So that year, Cray Research scaled back the MP line of computers. In response, the much-heralded Steve Chen quit Cray Research and started his own company, Supercomputer Systems. Supercomputer Systems took $150 million of investment money from IBM and other investors like Ford and Boeing, but went bankrupt in 1993. In 1989, the company could no longer accommodate its former founder. Seymour Cray joined a spin-off called Cray Computer Corporation, or CCC, in Colorado to work on the future Cray 3. Cray Research thusly would go onwards with the existing Cray XMP architecture, building the ecosystem. The Cray 3 would have used gallium arsenide semiconductors for switching performance far faster than what was possible with silicon. It necessitated buying a lot of chip-making equipment. The Cray 3 soon fell behind, and in 1991, various customers started canceling their orders because of cratering defense demand after the fall of the Soviet Union. CCC would only sell one system before filing for bankruptcy in 1995. An announced Cray 4 never materialized either. Seymour Cray's cherished approach of sitting down with a clean sheet of paper and building a big iron supercomputer was no longer financially viable. Seymour Cray formed a new company, SRC Computers, to begin exploring parallel designs, but he then passed away in 1996 at the age of 71 due to injuries from a car accident. Cray Research was eventually sold to Silicon Graphics, and it bounced around for a while, but is now part of Hewlett-Packard Enterprise as just Cray Inc. Advancing semiconductor technologies have made the supercomputers of the past seem comically behind. In 2010, an electrical engineer named Chris Fenton did a project to emulate the Cray 1A supercomputer using a Xilinx Spartan 3E1600 development board. He even put it into a cute little Cray 1 package, and it now sits in the Computer History Museum, where it inspired this video. Today's leading-edge semiconductor makers now face the same issues as Cray did with his supercomputers: thermal problems, interconnect problems, slowdowns due to memory retrieval. I am struck by the similarities. Unfortunately, the semiconductor industry cannot do as Seymour did, throw it all out and start anew with a fresh sheet of paper. All right, everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.